Today's talk is given by Dr. Phil Barty, based here in Geosciences. His talk is entitled The 2010-11 Christchurch New England Earthquakes and the Role Played by GIS. After various technical support and GIS roles, Phil decided to become a free agent, travelling the globe. His wanderings took him as far as New Zealand, however, realising that GIS jobs were requiring a further qualification, he found himself back in Edinburgh on the MSc in GIS. And I think we can take that as an endorsement of the course, having travelled half the globe. So following this, as fortune would have it, Phil managed to secure work with our now also very own Professor Jamie Pierce back in Christchurch, the University of Canterbury. And after this contract, some further jobs, a small matter of a PhD in there, also at the University of Canterbury. And this successfully completed Phil, strangely enough, traversed half the globe and is back here in Edinburgh, now working with Dr. William McInnes on the Spacebook project. Phil's research interests include location-based services, augmented reality, urban visibility modelling, and human-computer interfaces. You may well ask then why today Phil is here to talk about earthquakes. So, therefore, without further ado, let's find out. Phil.
Okay, thanks, Dan. I think it's everyone's coming. So, the talk slightly changed the title because it's and other stuff, because GIS is a very small part of the talk, and really I'm kind of a lay person when it comes to earthquakes, and there's kind of some other bits and pieces that are kind of chucked in there. Anyone that I only want to use that for background picture? It was in New Zealand. There's two kind of clues here to my talk. One is this steam here, which is geothermal, so hot pool, completely natural hot pool. And the mountains in the distance are part of the Southern Alps, which are formed by tectonic processes. So New Zealand is probably aware it's quite a geothermally active place. And this is what the locals do, they like to stick their feet into the hot pools after a cold day or after a long walk. So I thought we'd start off with this background, and I went for white, which I think is quite a nice kind of colour. So New Zealand. Well, New Zealand's on the inside of the globe, and a bit closer to where we're talking about. So New Zealand's got a population of about 4 million people, and about 3 million of those live in the North Island, and the very imaginatively named South Island has about 1 million people, of which the majority live in Christchurch. And so if you're going on holiday to New Zealand, 3 weeks, spend 2 weeks in the South Island, just 1 week in the North Island, because all the beautiful stuff's really in the South Island. So Christchurch is only about 350,000 people, something like that, 350,000 to 400,000 people. So the rest of the people in the South Island and the others are sort of scattered fairly low density across the South Island. That's a picture of me, just so you can recognise what I look like. And there's a close-up of me there. Okay, so I'm not a geologist, I'm not a volcanologist, I kind of play with GIS stuff, and I just happened to be in New Zealand at the time of this earthquake, and I thought, when I was asked to speak about something, maybe this would be just a kind of a different talk for me, not a kind of academic one, but more kind of perhaps an emotional experience one, but looking also at how GIS technology has been used in this kind of area. So this talk's actually been certified as Certificate 18. That's not because I'm swearing or doing any nudity in front of you, but because some of the video clips I've got here may be a bit shocking. So I apologise for that in advance if your screamish and stuff may be a little wank. I thought I'd start off with a question for you. Who here has experienced an earthquake? So who's cool? So at the end, you can probably chat to you about your experience and see if you can kind of draw that. And who here knows what to do if there is an earthquake? So, the advice from New Zealand's sort of government is if there's an earthquake to let them move more than a few steps and to drop cover and hold on to something or someone if you want. And basically, the firemen that had become a chat to or met said their advice was never go anywhere you can't see because so many people get injured or killed from running out of buildings and it's the falling masonry from the tops of the buildings coming down there that will hit them. And they just stayed in the room and then waited for it to settle down and then gone outside into the safe space. That's a better thing. So, just in case. So, all lectures in New Zealand, you have to start with this. So, that is. Britain, yeah. So Britain has earthquakes. And this was just from yesterday, I'm over there, earthquakes from the British Geological Society. You can see there are a few, obviously, fairly low magnitudes. But they did exist. There has been a fairly damaging one there in 1884, where 1,200 buildings needed repair. Chimneys collapsed and walls cracked and so on. So, apparently, it's a fairly sizable one. I think that's 6.1 is the largest ever recorded. Why does Britain get earthquakes? Well, obviously, plates are moving around us, and so as an event of that, the plate underneath us kind of shifts around. But also because of the ice that's melted, and the land sort of bouncing back as part of that. Closer to home, of course, Bruce, I think probably one of the first sort of mash-ups that I'm aware of, anyway, 1995, so, I think, devised this worldwide wide earthquake locator, which is still running today. And it takes data from USGS and presents it into a kind of online mapping system where people can, like, you know, visualise the output and interrogate data. So, you know, right in this department, some of the sort of origins, as far as I'm aware, of the kind of presentation of other people's data on maps. So my talk is really a little bit about life in New Zealand before the earthquake of September 2010. And then I'll talk a little bit about the quakes themselves, and that's why I'll do some sort of video clips. I think that actually shows much more effectively than I can explain in words just what it's like living through a quake. And then afterwards, to really kind of the GIS stuff, with kind of responses and future plans and where GIS comes into it. So New Zealand before 4th September was pretty much roaming around with long coats, long hair, big beards. If you were rich, you had horse. That's pretty much what our life was like, anyway. It was also all about jet boats and crazy sports, because the Kiwis love outdoor stuff. So this is called zorbing, for anyone who's not come across it. You jump in this ball and you roll down a hill. And if you're really adventurous, you fill the ball with water and get a washing cycle. They're also quite good at rugby. So, yeah, pretty good sport. Obviously, the kind of Maori cultural stuff. They have Maori events. Lots of silver ferns, which is kind of the national emblem. They think they invented the pavlova, and there's a big argument with Australia, but they named it after a Russian ballet dancer, so they don't quite know why. But, you know, they think they invented the pavlova, and of course they've got some pretty strange animals, like the kiwi, a flightless bird. And they also are pretty good with fashion. Like the guys particularly have got this idea of fashion. Short sleeve shirt, shorts, and then body boots. And all together, the girls love to do the same. So it's actually quite easy to shop and easy to play. They actually have their own whiskey as well, which is quite cool. So it's from Milford, which is the south island. But it doesn't make it anymore, it's just got like barrels of it stashed back in Angaroo, if you know what that is. Okay, so Christchurch is a garden city, and as I kind of said at the beginning, it has it's the biggest populated area of the South Island, with about 390,000 people in June of 2010. Territorial-wise, it's about the urban area is about twice as big as Edinburgh. It's got about the same number of people, so you can imagine the urban density is kind of, you know, half as much. Hence, lots of kind of green space. So lots of people's houses, you know, gardens, that kind of thing. They did have a working drought system, which is quite good. And they used to have pumps there as well. And so they're very much kind of inspired by sort of English sort of thing. In fact, it's kind of considered to be more English than most English cities these days. And it was set up by a New Zealand company who were based in London. And their basic mandate was to head out to the Southern Hemisphere and stamp a good English society like plan on some of the places down there and take with them the ideas of the Church of England and so on. And Robert John Godley, who's this statue here, was educated at Christchurch, Oxford, and he arrived in Lytton working on behalf of the New Zealand company to basically set up Christchurch. And his idea was, I don't want to be the governor here, I want it to be self-governing, so I don't want to rule it, but I want it to be self-governing. So he stayed for only 2 years. As you can see, like the church and the main cathedral is very kind of English inspired. And this here is the port of Lyttelton, which is the main kind of active port where actually where Robert Godley arrived. So on the map, that is really the centre of Christchurch City, is this cathedral here, the Robert Godley statue here. That's called Cathedral Square, although it's not really the square, but that's kind of the main heart of Christchurch City. Looking from kind of above, looking west here, so this is Christchurch, and pretty much where the sea is where that cathedral was, looking at Cathedral Square. This is a really big braided river system called the Waimakariri. The A is the Southern Alps, which I'll show you an overview of in a second. That's a big mountain range. This is New Brighton. That's kind of a beach area, and a beach community thing. The L is Littleton Harbour, and the P is the Port Hills. So this, as you can see, is incredibly flat expanse. It's called the Canterbury Plains. There's the Alpine Hills on one side, there's the Port Hills on this side. And the reason I'm looking at the Port Hills will come a bit more obvious later. It's incredibly flat, and underneath these plains is a set of aquifers. So these aquifers are where Christchurch gets its water supply from, and it's been, you know, water's been going there for hundreds of years. The water's incredibly pure, it's just like drinking mineral water. And it's only about 60 kilometres to get to the kind of foothills. So Christchurch there is in there. So looking sort of west-southwest across the Port Hills, you can see one side you've got Littleton, on the other side you've got Christchurch. These Port Hills are just fantastic for, as a big playground for adults. So like mountain biking, running, rock climbing, all those kinds of activities that we've done in the Port Hills. Okay, so if you're in a house in New Zealand, as we do, still do, you basically pay a small amount of money when you join a house to something called EQC, the Earthquake Commission. And that's because New Zealand is very aware of the fact that you can't normally insure land. You can insure your house, but the land it's on can't be insured. And because of its incredibly active tectonic history and also because of its position, with this huge alpine fault running down the backbone of the country, they thought we've got to have some kind of insurance pot for people to be able to perhaps fix land. So every year, in your insurance policy, is a levy paid to the EQC at about $70. And they've been doing this up for ages, and there's something like $5 billion in there. And they've been expecting a sort of great quake on the Alpine Fault region for a while now, because they traditionally happened about every 150 years. But it's been 294 years since one's happened. And they think this next great quake on the Alpine Fault is going to be like massive, like 8 plus magnitude. The ground's going to be moving 8 metres, that kind of distance. It's like me running to the end of the river back kind of thing. And vertically, sort of 4 metre shifts, so a pretty powerful quake. And it's going to last probably about 2 minutes of shaking, because this fault line, like the Alpine Fault, is about 400 kilometres long, and it's sort of fairly stable mathematics that describes how long a fault of that kind of length would take to break, and therefore how shaking would occur afterwards. So this is just kind of looking at the Alpine Fault line, or the Alpine Fault. And the Alps themselves, it's incredibly straight. It's amazing to put a ruler down there. That line down the Alps there is incredibly well marked. So they're pretty good on publicising, and the first thing we noticed when we got to New Zealand was how much, you know, adverts on TV, signs that were about, you know, get through it, and thinking, what are we doing? What's going on? And they're just kind of trying to push to everyone's minds the importance of being prepared, like storing up water. So a friend of ours said to us, oh, every time I drink a bottle of Coke or orange juice, I just wash it out, fill it with water, chuck it in the garage. So we started doing the same thing, like, you know, pretty soon after getting there. So we had, like, you know, 80 litres of water just chucked in the garage out of the way. Store food, so we bought tins of soup and just stacked them at the back of the shelf in case we ever needed them. Have your own gas cooker, because you might not have any electricity or cooking facilities. So we just had a little camping gas thing, this kind of thing. So we kind of sort of noticed a few things that they were saying, which was very fortuitous. They also have an EQIQ site where they try and, you know, again, encourage people to be prepared. And they take you through, like, a typical house. And you can put this through a little simulator and shake it on the screen. And then you can do things to it, like bolt the TV down or bolt shelves, bookshelves that are freestanding to the wall. And then do the simulation again and see how it affects things. They're trying to educate people to make their house safe, because it is such a big issue. Okay, so earthquakes are quantified, and there's many different ways of doing it. But the one I'll mostly be referring to is the Richter scale. I guess most people are familiar with this. So it's a quantification of energy. based on the size of the largest seismic wave. What's kind of interesting about it is the scale is logarithmic. So each shifting up from magnitude 4 to magnitude 5, magnitude 5 is 10 times as strong as the magnitude 4, and so on. So magnitude 6 would be 100 times stronger than magnitude 4, magnitude 7 would be 1,000 times stronger than magnitude 4. So it's a pretty amazing leap from magnitude 4 to magnitude 5. They often also express the energy from earthquake in terms of number of tons of TNT. It's like a magnitude earthquake being equivalent to about 6 million tons of TNT being let off, which is pretty hard to imagine, really. And a magnitude 4.6 or greater quake actually felt everywhere around the world by other seismographs. So in other countries, like the USGS or whatever, would pick up 4.6 quakes from meteors and so on. So I just need to get this point across. So magnitude 4 to 5 is 10 times more powerful. So 4 to 6 would be 100 times, 4 to 7 would be 1,000 times. So Friday, the 3rd of September, and starts spring, Southern Hemisphere, and it's about 15 degrees, which is quite nice. And I was writing up my PhD, and I was about to submit to around this, writing up my PhD this time, and really paying attention to what I was doing, and not being distracted at all by the local neighbourhood cat that keeps coming around. And our friend Matt, who some of you may know, he used to work at the Auburn Survey, who was the one who told us to store water up there, he just had a big whiskey night because he joined a whiskey tasting club, and he wanted to stay at our house for the night. So he said, yeah, can we just crash on our couch? That'd be fine. So we were all enough to bed, and of course, 4:35 a.m. happens, and this is kind of what happens. It's dark. So that's about 40 seconds, that's how long it should fall. So it feels, 40 seconds doesn't sound much, but actually it was pretty scary. And it's completely dark. Obviously there's no power now, so we torches for that. And we did what we have to do, which is, panic, and then get together and go outside. So we went outside, and we sat in our car, because it was quite cold at night. There's no electricity. We didn't have a radio, which was really stupid. But our car had a radio, it also had a heater. So we jumped in our car, turned on the heater, and listened to the radio. And then, of course, all the neighbours were coming out, so we just had a chat with them. But we just sat in the car for like 3 or 4 hours, jumping out occasionally to get another cup of tea ready from their little gas speaker. And, of course, having more shakes, because it's not just one event. And we thought, it's the Alpine fault. We survived it, that was a huge one. We managed to get through it, the house was kind of basically up, and we're okay. And, we thought that was it. But then on the radio in the car, we basically heard them saying that the epicenter was near Darfield, which is just outside Christchurch. I mean, is that the Alpine fault? I don't think so, it's weird. And then it was a 7.1 on the Richter scale, which is a pretty significant event. While we were sitting in the car, people decided to take photographs of the cracks in the road. And then in the morning, we set up our little gas cooker and made ourselves breakfast. And this was kind of the drum reading. So it's normally, these are different seismographs around New Zealand, and they do a triangulation to work out where they think the epicenter is. Obviously, it was so violent that all the drums, just, the signal from all of them was so great, it covers the entire thing. So the epicenter was near Darfield. So Christchurch is here, Littleton's here, this is kind of Port Hills here, and it was out this way, about 40 kilometres or 25 miles west of Christchurch, and not on the Alpine fault at all. So we're starting, everyone's kind of wondering what's going on, and it's been kind of concerning, I guess. They announced there was a new discovery fault, which they called the Green Day fault, because that's actually the name of the nearest town. And it's thought to have been inactive for about 16,000 years. And the reason they didn't know about it is because of this alluvial plain at the bottom of the mountains, basically just covering any evidence of any kind of fault activity. And so this guy, Dr. Quigg, Mark Quigley, who's a University of Canterbury lecturer, he's actually Canadian, but he put on all of the public talks, which were incredible, and he's got this really amazing kind of blog it's worth looking at. He kind of says there about this ethnic being mainly one of these strike slip kind of folks. So if you're interested in the technical stuff, it's worth sort of following that guy. But he went out with some others and they started doing fault traces, you know, from helicopters and also ground equipment, looking at the lines. And you can see here, this was originally like a straight hedge, but it's kind of snapped. And they found about 1.5 metres of vertical movement in places. And they went out and captured it and found that this fault was about 28 kilometres long. Based on their calculations, that would be about 40-second shape. So it seemed like most of the fault had gone in one go, which is kind of good news. So we were kind of, you know, calming down, thinking these aftershocks are going to die away pretty soon. He went out and did lots more mapping with groups of people and university postdocs who were out there in 11. And in their lecture, they were really excited. There's another lecturer across from America who said his first experience with the quake was the jumped up was, that's the wrong frequency for the Alpine fault, it could still be somewhere else. Because the Alpine fault would be along the slow chain. It's just like, these guys are in their element. And because it was a 4 a.m. shake, most people were asleep. So although there was like kind of collateral damage, there was very little loss of life. So it was more of a kind of stunning thing for them, right? If it was a big sign. They also started making these maps, which I don't understand, it's like beach balls. And they, something to do with earthquakes, but yeah, not technical. They went out and put some sort of ground-based survey equipment. They borrowed University of Calgary's little jeep and went up down the beach. And they started trying to map where they could find the faults underneath. This was much more what I can relate to as a non-volcanologist geologist. Physical damage you need to see around was just incredible. Just walls and bridges and train track was like massive bend, isn't it? In the end, we heard that like two people had died from falling objects, and one person had died from a heart attack, although it couldn't be directly linked, but was probably as a result of kind of shock. Right. So this is a log of the quakes around within 50 kilometres of Cathedral Square. So up to this point here, that's the kind of background number of quakes experienced felt in within 50 kilometres of Christchurch's sort of central heart. Then you see September 2010 comes along, and it all just goes crazy. This is a year later, so this is where we are now, like November 2011, over a year later, and still massively high, massively raised number of earthquakes. So all these technically referred to as aftershocks. An aftershock is an earthquake. It's just until this level returns to what it was pre this event, like just a few earthquakes in itself, these will all be called aftershocks. And each of these aftershocks, like some of these bigger ones, will have their own aftershocks built into that. So it gets quite difficult when, from an insurance EQC point of view, when they decide it's a new event. So there's been, this is a new event. This would be a new event, and this would be a new event here. So those are new kind of insurance policy events. You can see there's been loads of them. In fact, there's been over 7,600 since September. So it's just like an incredible kind of, I have no comprehension at all of this. I remember at school about kind of earthquakes and thinking, oh yeah, secondary ones and stuff, but no comprehension at all. It'd be interesting to see if some other people experience earthquakes if they've had this kind of aftershock sequence, because I see lots of rumours about, perhaps this is slightly unusual. So in terms of, we had the one big 7.1, we had 32 measuring 5 or above, so that's a pretty damaging kind of ongoing aftershock sequence. Then on Boxing Day, everyone here has been a few months, everyone has sort of calmed down a bit, go back shopping here at Boxing Day sales. In the middle of town, there was an earthquake of 4.9, which wasn't, so big in terms of the size of it, but because it was now located, it moved, and it was now an epicenter underneath the centre of town, actually caused quite a lot of damage to the buildings in the city. And so that really kind of scared people quite a lot, and shut off power to 40,000 homes, and then the central city was shut down for a few days. I need to play you a video here, so this is the actual box in the event. Southeast of Christchurch. So it's people in the Port Hills. And they're still sort of looking at reasons why, but I think the Port Hills actually act as some kind of buffer. It's like being punched underneath with a surf break, hit the Port Hill rock on top and then sent that sideways, because somehow the following sort of shakes have amplified out towards Christchurch. And as I'm sure everyone's aware of Tobler's first order of drifting, which is? So anything that's closer to the drifting is probably more effective. Of course, this earthquake is much closer to Christchurch, much shallower, therefore it's going to have a much bigger effect on the city itself. This was our house, so just, you know, bookshelves that we hadn't screwed to the wall because we're naughty. Covers just dumped on the floor, glass everywhere. And this video shows what happened when, in the following minutes. So I mentioned the country plains are like a huge set of aquifers. When the ground shakes, that water starts squirting everywhere. And it brings up the finer sediments. And then of course the water drains away and leaves the finer sediments and these kind of volcanic plumes. You can see it's kind of flooding from underneath. So this is kind of, yeah, it's a bit shocking. It's in Cathedral Square, at the heart of the city. As well as liquefaction, there's also burst water pipes, so you just end up with like kind of this kind of disaster thing. And supermarkets and bottle shops and like kind of thing just pulling out the shelves dumped onto the ground. So even if the supermarket structure was okay, it would be shut and obviously it wouldn't be available for people to go and buy stuff for quite a while and it was being flooded up. It's a pretty amazing destruction, images of buildings. Cathedral lost its spire and I think they just decided they're not going to rebuild it. 200 kilometres away, 30 million tonnes of ice broke off the Tasman Glacier and it created a 3.5 metre wave and just went up and down the lake. People were on boats, like you know, tourist boats, so they saw this wave going over for about half an hour. This is the kind of access road for our Littleton across the Port Hills into Christchurch. Just massive boulders falling off and just blocking the road. Houses that are destroyed. Statues falling over. And this is an amazing work. This is an amazing escape.
This is a typical street scene in lunchtime Christchurch, where there's a road nearby. Suddenly, there's a cafe on the corner of Liverpool Street. Then, bang, it's gone. clinging debris and dust to the ground. It's hard to see. Strangers thrown together at this moment, reaching out to each other.
Complete strangers, here you go, with his own family.
Out of the dust emerges a man who'd been sheltering by the cafe wall. He walks free.
Kind of raises his hands, he can't say those words.
As he keeps on walking, others soon come into view. The shaking stops. 24 seconds, it's over. From another angle now, see the cars rocking. Now watch the jogger in red as he dodges the falling brakes and dust. And amazingly, just keeps on running.
Anyone spot anything a bit odd about this photo? Kind of plant, that is. So, yeah, I think the police have got it. And liquefaction, yes. This liquefaction occurred everywhere in cars that are getting bogged down. This kind of silt that had plateaued it. The ground that we shake itself would turn to jelly. This is just behind our house. There's a kind of park and where you walk and there's this here. Just like on these volcanic plume things, they call the volcanoes, whatever. And this happened everywhere as well, which was quite a shock to me. So the earth turns to like liquid. These drain pipes are essentially hollow tubes, so they float. The ground is heavy, so it sinks. So what happens is basically all the drain pipes just punch their way out through the streets, and that just happened like everywhere across all the streets, just all over the place. So, you know, they just pull big mounds up there, so you know you've got loads of people in the front throwing the drive around. But that's okay, just keep using like four-wheel drives. And this is a liquefaction. So this is river here, obviously, but all this water in here is actually from liquefaction. And now we've just got suburbs of Christchurch and never repeat rebuilt. This is like the park. Just so this is normally the end of the water line down here. So you push water from underneath. How's this sunk? So this one, you see the height of the windows? They're about, 50 centimetres. They've sunk down about 50 centimetres. Garages sinking. Concrete pads that were heavy sinking, bringing fences with it. Telegraph poles or power poles were starting to lean across and even snapping cables or cables getting to the danger had to be disconnected. So that was a safe place to be for a neighbouring cat. So the council made some maps of liquefaction. So this was what it looked like after the set earthquake, the initial one. This is the 7.1 quake. So not too bad really, it was just like a kind of couple of spots. But this is what it looked like after the February one. It's just like the whole east side is getting covered in liquefaction. It wasn't an unknown threat or an unknown concern. So they'd actually made maps a long time ago and made these kind of publicly available. But the detail on this map is kind of somewhat limited. That was kind of it. But what can you do anyway? If you bought a house somewhere, you'll live somewhere. That's where the city's built. So during this time, we were without power for a couple of days. We were without water or sewage for about a week and a half. Obviously, no TV, no power, no internet. So you're actually in this incredible kind of blackout. You're in the middle of this event, and the only way you know about anything is from radio and word of mouth. And it's kind of a weird thing. The mobile telephone was probably the best way of communicating in many ways, but obviously the network was running on backup power and very limited bandwidth, so we knew how to use it. So 181 people sadly died in this event, but 2,000 people injured. So it's quite a sad loss of life. Power was lost 30% of the city. Runway was shut. Hospital, even though it was on kind of suspension rollers, still got damaged. They had to shut partway down. University was shut for like over a month. Schools have to share. Still share today. So schools damaged. So school A comes in the morning. They go home. School B comes into that premises in the afternoon. So it's kind of completely changed the life in that respect. The 2011 census was cancelled in 2013, and 10,000 houses have been demolished. That was a view from the foothills of the actual February quake, just a kind of dust cloud that came up. Someone was up in the foothills having fun, and they saw this. So it's a good photo of it. We then had to buy, I think, 10,000 or something Waterloos. So there's this incredible influx of Waterloos all around Christchurch. And then associated with that, lots of trucks, interesting name, East Place on Wheels. So lots of these trucks appeared, you know, driving down the streets, and then people made their own as well. Now another way of quantifying quakes is to look at acceleration. So rather than talking about magnitudes or Richter scale stuff, you can measure the G acceleration. And the Christchurch quake of February and June were 2.2 G and 2.1 G, respectively, which were the highest experienced recorded Gs anywhere in the world, up until until the Japanese one happened just afterwards. So, and that, you know, 2.5 times gravity being shaken around is quite incredible. And this was actually recorded from lots of sensors, so that Mark Quigley and his team got a little USB accelerometer, it's like cable phones, and they gave them out to people, distributed around the city, and you plug them into your computer, just leave it on, and it records data and just sends it back over the internet. When it can to them, they just end up with this incredibly dense network of acceleration values from different places around the city. Lots of people must have really went out and just helped tidy out the liquefaction, because it's just a real mess everywhere. And it gets dry and dusty, and it was really nasty. So this is the tallest hotel in the background there. It's still up, but it's leaning quite badly, so it's going to have to be deconstructed. Windows are smashed, all this kind of stuff. So this is a time ball in Lifton, now they're no longer. You can see the lean on that hotel there. So it's been still up and it's going to be deconstructed. But it will happen again in June, so I'm going to go through all the details. All the same stuff, slightly different location now out here. More liquefaction, liquefaction and maybe power on kind of thing. This is just a video that shows kind of the movement of the ground. Just watch this crack. Narrow and close it.
That's incredible. Awesome slant.
Yeah, that is cool.
That's incredible. Look what I'm doing.
So yeah, the ground's moving, as you can see the cracks doing that. There's the Port Hills, some really nice houses around there, but unfortunately these rocks, this old volcano, it's quite loose. The rocks came bouncing off down the hills and going straight through people's houses. But with the Kiwi Centre of Cuba, they put this on their equivalent of eBay trying to sell it. and they called it Rocky, and it says he's in pristine condition, just a little bit of concrete dust, suitable for the garden feature, or in our case, a magnificent addition to your living area. When it comes to an indoor apple flow. And it actually sold for, the winning bid was $50,000, the second bid was $10,000, and ended up both paying, so $60,000 went to the charity to help rebuild the city. Okay, so, how long have we got? 5 minutes?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, okay.
So now on to after the credits, and we'll look at the sort of GIS stuff. So I said, like, Mark Quigley, if you're really interested, he's put together a whole series of benches and notes, technical stuff, which I don't really understand, but it's online if you're interested. The council went out and reflew the city with LIDAR. This is actually post-September, I don't have post-February stuff, but they're interested in, like, you know, what buildings have changed and the elevation land changes, that kind of thing. So lots of LIDAR data. Which they can only give away. There's also some things done from satellites, interferogram, looking at the kind of movement of the Earth in relation to, you know, like the satellite, basically. So has that piece of land moved up or sunk down? Maps of what power was still out, which parts of the city needs power to be fixed. And then the GNS, which is the Geological Nuclear Science kind of department, part of government. Made these maps of where they found the original Green Day fault and then these other faults that were happening in the Port Hills, which were separate faults. And they discovered now that it's just like a massive network of faults underneath these plains. And so they, you know, started plotting earthquake maps. I also have an online website where you can, you know, kind of click in, zoom in, click on things to get some information about it. And see kind of trends of what's happened over the last few days, years, whatever. And you can record what you felt. So this is now using another scale, the modified Mercalli scale, where, you know, how did the earthquake feel where you coming are? So you just go onto Google Maps through the GNS website and click on there and say, how's it here? And ask all these kind of questions, like, were you standing up, were you laying in bed, or what happened, did the TV fall off its, you know, plinth, or those kinds of things. And they work out from that, from enough people in the same area getting kind of similar values, what they think the Mercalli scale is for different parts of the city. They also have a really open data policy, and they said, look, we've got the network, the size of graphs, we'll make all this data available to you. You can come on here and download it, download the raw CSV, and just put it through like Google Fusion tables quickly in 5 minutes, make you very happy with whatever you're interested in. So people started doing that, and we started to get lots of mashups. So the University of Canterbury's Paul Nichols came up with this, which is kind of an animated thing, which I'm going to show that. I guess you can imagine this basically steps through and these dots come and go through time. So people start to get an idea of the kind of sequence and pattern of events. This is another one, really similar. I will show you. So it's pretty much the same as one before, just slightly smoother animation. to get an idea of kind of spatial and temporal clusters. This one takes a second to load, and all right. So apologies for that. Basically the same thing in Google Earth, this time using elevation to represent depth, so it's kind of all the wrong way up, but it should go a bit. Because you can't plug into the Earth on Google Earth, so this guy's just going to use altitude as a way to represent the depth of the quake. Obviously the colour and size of the dot representing how large it was on the magnitude scale. So lots of this kind of thing started happening. There was a kind of crisis mapping group who used Ushahidi to kind of like collect data from SMSs, from anything that you find on the news, from other sources, like you could actually volunteer information yourself from their website, from the forum, various things, and tagged images, anything. And then put together this site called eqorg.nz, which doesn't exist anymore. But basically it's a crowdsourced Christchurch recovery map. And it's to try and get people, you know, this garage has got fuel, this garage has got water, this shop, the supermarket, whatever. So, and they had 100,000 unique visitors in the first week of the site going live, so it was quite heavily used. Like, so now it's not actually documented in the Wayback Machine or anything, because it was a relatively short time. And so you could submit your own reports and that kind of thing. So this was pretty popular. This is kind of what it looked like, with kind of clusters saying there's, you know, 339 things you know about this place, and you see, and then you get to see actual kind of point information underneath. The Christchurch City Council thought they'd have a go as well, and they thought it was quite what we knew with the Waterloos were. So they made a map of Waterloos, and also they linked into the kind of social stuff for Ushahidi and also YouTube and Flickr stuff as well. But I think the best one was this one, which was people who started playing this game, how big was that quake? I think it was a 6. And then, of course, you want to go to find it on a map somewhere. And the GNS one was a little bit clunky, so this guy took their data, put it onto Google Maps, made this incredibly easy to use, amazingly interactive interface called Quake, crow.co.nz, and that's his name, Crow. And still running today. And you can like look at the history of Quake, see where they were. You can click on a Quake and get its details. You can draw a box around the area of interest and then filter based on, so like the magnitude and time scale and the spatial area of what quakes happened in that area. You can see on the top 100 quakes. You also do graphs of like magnitude versus depth, the magnitude versus day, because you can see the kind of significant events in the aftershocks. And this one, which is quite interesting. So the triangulation of the seismic data takes maybe half an hour. And you just experience the shake. And the first thing is, was that a shake? Was it a Lorraine? Was it just me? I'm ultra sensitive. So what he did is he plotted the number of users looking at his website. And it was updated every 5 minutes. So this is a typical day from 8 a.m. through to lunchtime, through to 10 p.m. at night going to sleep. And then obviously this day there was a large earthquake of some description. So people started waking up near 2 a.m., 4 a.m., 6 a.m. So now there's, you know, 1,600 concurrent users on this website looking for information. So you're pretty sure if you see a spot like this, that was a real event. Just an interesting way of using another data source to kind of... he also has a Facebook group, kind of a very fast way of getting news from the crowd. Esri Cell been using it through a company called Eagle. They had a go at making a map, but to be honest, it was a bit too late and not as good as the other stuff, so I don't know if anyone really used it. And now what's happening is people are interested in making the area safer.
During the earthquake, because we are throwing the rockfalls from the same locations that
this
they
kind of source
from during the earthquake. And by videoing these, we can understand things such as how high the vents, what the rotation is, so their angular momentum as they're going down the slope. And all this is really important because you can imagine if you're building a rockfall fence, you want to make sure that your fence is high enough for boulders. And so what this does is allow us to calibrate the numerical models that will need to be done for design purposes, but also to give us an understanding of just what happened during the earthquake. And that these deflections may be plus or minus about 30 degrees from the centre of the average fault line. These yellow lines here represent the trajectories of the mapped rockfalls. And so you can see that there's trajectories all through here. This is Heathcote Valley. And this is over in Littleton, and the red circles are actually mapped boulder endpoints. So this is the source area, and this is where they're planted. And this is kind of the product of what we're doing. We're trying to delineate determines where rockfalls are probable or likely to impact. As
So that kind of work's going on now, they're actually doing that, pushing these rocks over to see where they go. There's also been a kind of initiative to set up a digital archive for everyone's kind of stories and all the kind of documentation that, happened during this event. That's kind of being built up now. As part of that, the local paper sets to set up the map site where you can record your story and the location where it happened. So you can like click on one point and actually see that person's feelings or whatever, photographs or whatever from that day. There's also GeoNet, when the GS people thought they need to upgrade their site, so they've done a lot of work to make it more like a pro site. And they've got this timeline thing now, where basically you can slide along here on months and then hours and just see like what happened where. There's also a pretty cool initiative to get people's ideas into the, rebuild, and this was done by the GIS department at Landcare Research. And so they had this idea of kind of a card game where you set up a card, like, I've got an idea, I'm going to use trams more. And then anyone else sees that idea and they can follow it on. So this was like a conversation thread, sort of topological link kind of thing. And you could then very quickly pick out the conversations which developed the longest, deepest kind of threads, which are probably the most interesting ideas, kind of perhaps dispose of the other ones and just concentrate on taking these and making policies based around some of these that get people more excited. Terralink, that's a local mapping company, set out with their kind of version of their Google Street car and recorded all the red zones. So the city is still locked down today, and they record to document what it looks like. So that's all available online for anyone to look at on this YouTube stream. Suburbs are still being zoned red, and houses are still being demolished, and there's still this kind of devastation throughout the city, and lots of work going on trying to repair it. I've just got one more video I'd like to show, then I'm finished. So this is the view from the air, what the city looks like now. You see they've been clearing out so much stuff, just loads of empty space. So I say about half of the buildings in the city have gone in the city centre. You can check where your house is in zone. So we were able to go online and click on our house. This isn't actually our house, but click on our house and see, you know, if your house is okay, if you think it's too damaged to be repaired, or if the survey ever mind yet. And you can also see what they think of the land. So these blue zones are where they think liquefaction is going to be likely in the future. The yellow zone is less likely, and grey is probably fine. That part of the city there, the red zone, is still completely locked down by army. So you still can't get into the city centre. But bits of it are opening up. So this is just opened. It's a kind of temporary shopping area where they're using containers. Various groups are trying to kind of make little mini parks in the city, temporary parks, just to make the place look a bit nicer. This is my final thing, and I'm finished. So the HIT Lab is a kind of research group in New Zealand. They're really interested in augmented reality. Smart Billinghurst, who's one of the professors they've set up. And they're really interested in this idea of, could you show people today, like now, who explore the city, what it used to look like using technology? So he's quite big into outdoor AR, which is superimposing virtual information into the real world in its correct location and trying to keep all tracks correctly. That's what the building used to look like at the top left. That's what it looks like now. Once that's cleared, could we show people that top left view in place? So they've developed this application. I just want to show you here for this thing. And you can download this from the Android store.
The face of that city is set to change forever. But what will the city look like? And will the old Christchurch be forgotten? Well, one leading technology expert says he found the solution using cutting-edge technology. Kim Bunnell with this.
They may be set happy, but don't mistake these two for disaster tourists. This is crucial work.
This is building of love for my life that are gone. And for my children and their children, you know, the only chance they can see them is through a medium like this.
Architect Jason Bell is mapping every inch of the city, although not how you expect.
We're taking HDR panoramas around the city, so similar to Google Street View, but sort of a full-length street view.
The photo has been taken here, Jason's earthquake-proof bunker.
Every thumb tag is positioned in the photo.
Each and every photo converting a building to a 3D image.
If I set up points of perspective, that we can take off the photo, and that allows me to align the photo, and then I can use any texture we can see in that image. I can then find the surface.
So how important do you think this technology will be in giving a new vision for Christchurch?
rather than just focusing as an opportunity to fully recreate what we're doing. And as a mindset change, it's a lot of people talking the way they're back to the high buildings. So it's actually a real impetus to look afresh at how we use space.
And space is what this city will have plenty of. Latest estimates put 350 central city buildings in need of demolition. And that's where Canterbury University and Professor Mark Billinghurst step in.
Hello.
Here, using Jason's models, the future of Christchurch comes to life.
So you can fly through the model and you can feel like you're standing in the city and seeing all the buildings around you. Traditional tools like print documents or still images, people sometimes don't get a real vision of what it would be like. And with this system, we can show good what it's like in life size.
It's called immersive visualization.
We show people what the city needs to look like, and then we can then replace buildings here as they get torn down or as we get alternate signs of the future.
It's just one of the ways Mark is giving the power back to the people of Canterbury.
Option A, well, quite like that one, we and an eyesight is something like they capture the data and use it as a way of providing great community engagement.
But if on the streets of Christchurch, technology becomes truly impressive. What are we doing here?
Sure, great. So this is the Earthquake AR software. This runs on a normal Android mobile phone. When I hold the phone like this, I can see a live camera view coming from the camera on the phone. But then using the GPS and the compass on the phone, we can overlay virtual models into the real world.
Gaming holds where smart buildings once stood, transformed.
In front of me, of course, is the where the Sinalo's course building was, but now it's just an empty site. When I look through here, as you can see, I can see a 3D model of the building that it used to be.
St. Elmo Court has been on this corner for more than 80 years. Now, using augmented reality technology, the glory is relived and reimagined.
And when we drag on the timeline here, we can go back and forward in time. So we can drag back to the left and we can see what it looked like 50 years ago. We can drag forward a little bit. We can see what it was like the day before the quake. And then we can go forward in time and we can see what it's going to be like in the future.
The plan to make models from architect's impressions for every demolished building, then get the software away for free.
You can use it for community feedback as well. So I can see the building on the site and I can add my own comments and thoughts. I might say, well, yeah, this new design is too big compared to the police station, or I don't like the colour.
This team, certain Cantabrians, sick of hearing their city called shattered, will find a way forward.
It's just going to completely change the face of the city. We've been through the red zones, the areas that are completely wiped out. But it's a clean canvas for something new, something exciting.
Say thanks for listening, that's me.
Any questions? Listen, stop tour. You did an admirable job to get right on the dot. Plenty of time for questions. So, who wants to go first?
I'm curious if, people who've experienced those races, do you have so many aftershocks? Like, is that kind of your experience?
Digit system is built for first responders so that they can plot evacuation routes or different sources of road access to areas of the
problem. I guess the fleets are essential kind of body in terms of information and control of the streets and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I guess they would be involved in it, but I'm afraid I'm not really wasn't privy to that information. So we were pretty much like an information blackout. We knew less about it than Brentford's on the other side of the world. So I'm not actually sure what the actual pathway is.
Yeah, what's wrong? Have you been sort of traumatised by the experience that won't go back again to Christchurch? Is there a thought that you should actually forget from Christchurch and to go build somewhere else?
There have been these discussions. So one of the ideas was all the liquefaction that happened on the east side of the city, why don't we just kind of turn that into parks and then move the city to where Hackney Park is, which is currently about the same kind of area. but sort of the cost would just be too high, the infrastructure and so on. And the city council was saying, well, actually, you know, we can repair lots of this, and it's better to repair it and then just take certain zones out that are too damaged rather than like erase the city. And I think, I mean, this, you know, people have massive, you know, histories and networks, communities and stuff that you couldn't just pick it up and rebuild the city. But obviously there's lots of heartache as well. There's certain communities like Broadlands, I think it's just yesterday we told a group of 400 houses are now, they're just going to nullify the area and just all those people have to move somewhere else. But that becomes a huge issue with insurance companies as well, because if your house is okay, but the land is damaged, the insurance companies are saying, well, you're only insured for the house. So then, of course, EQC, who are insuring the land, are saying, well, you know, we need to find somewhere else to move you to, and we don't have enough money to, you know, kind of buy up everyone's houses, so it becomes a real issue there. But also, be on the street where everyone on the street is damaged apart from your house, maybe your house and your land's fine. So then the government's not putting services back in. So effectively your house is now kind of useless. And so there's like issues. It's easier to cope with those, like just independent sort of cases here and there, rather than just, I think, blanket the city. They did talk about trying to move it, and it's just too big an issue.
You said that like the hospital was built on the earthquake rollers.
Yeah.
Like obviously in Japan, like a lot of the massive buildings are more on the rollers.
Yeah.
Is there like, are they planning to build, like rebuild, like incorporate these technologies in the rebuilding process?
So, yeah, definitely. So, probably picked out lots of the images I showed with damaged houses and bricks. Our house was actually wooden, any kind of flexes. And the University of Canterbury, before the quake, had been developing technologies to join together huge, like timber framed skyscrapers and like new kind of joints. And so, basically, since the earthquake, they've received quite a lot of money to take that forward to actually become a product. So I think lots of the new design, like that guy was saying at the end there, people don't want to go back into 7-story, 10-story buildings, but they might build 4 or 5-story one and use kind of timber frame which flexes and is therefore much stronger. And there's also a lot of work going on in like drilling down using like kind of piles into the ground to prevent any wind fraction. Because even if you've got that kind of roller thing in wind fraction, just the way the building is sink and then the whole building kind of tilts. And I think I might say this is the worst case of wind fraction ever recorded like in the world. So it's kind of an unprecedented level at which kind of communities have to cope with this kind of thing. But obviously learn from it, and the university is very active in trying to design a new city that will be able to take these kind of things into account, doing like rollers and other techniques. Yeah.
Have they got a forecast for the future? I mean, clearly there's still options, but have they got an idea how this is going to be? Is there going to be another major?
Yeah, so there's a scientific and another approach. There's one guy called Ken Moon, who had studied about, Ken Green, who had studied about the moon's effect on it all, and he's written like book predictions, which is basically pseudoscience rubbish. But the actual real scientists have always been running a model since day one of the off-the-shelf sequence, and every month they kind of roughly estimate how many magnitude 5s or how many magnitude 6s or kind of they expect to happen. And they plot alongside it having actually occurred. It's pretty incredible. It's kind of, it doesn't just drop off like that, it's kind of more like an S kind of wavy shape. So it drops off and then there's a lull period and we start to get nervous as residents thinking, oh, it was coming, and then sure enough there's kind of a build up as the pressure builds up. But it kind of eventually takes off. They're very cautious, no one could predict earthquakes, they're very cautious to say that's the end. But they keep saying that, you know, the general rule of thumb is that after a magnitude 7 earthquake, you'd expect the next largest aftershock to be one magnitude lower, so magnitude 6, which just happened. So after that 6, you expect that one to kind of have 5, and that's going to happen. So they kind of said, well, it kind of seems like the sequence is coming to an end now, but no one wants to really kind of put their hand and say that's it.
I have one on that.
Yeah.
But in terms of characterising the profile of aftershocks, what about spatial variability? Because you can put them on a curve, you do it log, you get a straight line, you can come up with a magic number.
Yeah.
But how does that vary across the region? Is that of use and is that in the public domain?
I'm not aware of it. Obviously, there's massive variation spatially because of different types of geologies, different types of soil types, all those kinds of things. And the actual seismometers aren't, you know, that dense, they kind of scattered around the country. So there's lots of kind of approximation. And very often, the first result you hear, like it was a 7.2 initially, it gets downgraded to 7.1. As the science kind of gets refined. And I think any local area's expression of how strong the earthquake was, you can't do it with magnitude, you need to do that acceleration. So that's why they've put around this one, 1,000 sensors around the city to measure in this location how the ground is. And from that, perhaps try and infer risk and perhaps geology. That's what I'm saying.
Back.
Yes.
Yeah.
An observation, it's not a question. Just speaking as a biologist looking in, I was intrigued by your point about the modelling and the insurance companies and that sort of stuff. As biologists, we've had for a long time the problems of dealing with biology and politics and people, GMOs and stem cells, etc., etc. And one of the things that I've been interested in for quite a long time is how the GI community relates to society in terms of some of these big issues. So we've got, in our country, we've got flood mapping and insurance companies saying, well, actually, yeah, we see the data, we can't have insurance. There you're talking about earthquake potential modelling, insurance companies saying, well, yeah, we'll insure your house, we're not going to insure you out under you. And I think my observation is, there's a question, are you in the GI community actually geared up to this relationship with society, relationship with politics, and relationship with people about some of this big data stuff?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I don't know if I can speak to the GI community, but there's, pretty far as the map. There's a map I showed earlier of that kind of where your house zones, whether it's yellow or red. And actually, one of our friends works for the group, works for the group doing that, and they're being incredibly controlled. Like, so he wasn't allowed to come into work until a certain time, and they had to work through the night to get their kind of the map made, because the map contained information about what was going to happen to suburbs of the city, which is massively influential politically, economically, and, you know, people's lives depend on it. And the news would be released at like 9 a.m. or something, and it had literally only been assembled that night from the data. So the field technicians are going out collecting information about like the quality of the soil or the kind of map liquefaction and so on. And then he would get it that day, and he had to process it during the night and get it out. Because they were really worried about, I guess, leaking information and that kind of stuff. But I'm not sure how the GI community is set up to deal with that. But obviously, in this particular case, the sensitive information had to be kind of controlled by the executives above. I probably didn't answer your question at all. But.
No, I simply say that in that we as a community, whether it's a scientific community, biology community, or whether it's a GI community, we kind of think that what we say is scientific, therefore, you know, it's okay, but it's the interpretation of it and how we then, you know, interact with that interpretation. I think that's the thing that I'm quite interested in. You know, how we then with the public about the interpretation of it, out of data.
Yeah. So what happened in Christchurch, they set up something called CERA, C-E-R-A, which was Canterbury Earthquake Reconstruction Authority, I think. And their job is to kind of connect it very strongly with government, plus with industry and GI people working for them. And basically they would take results from the GI people and work to make new policies. And they, CERA works with the insurance companies directly. So there was a massive delay from the end of the kind of February earthquake until anyone heard anything about insurance, because all the insurance companies just said we're not going to talk to anyone until we negotiated CERA. CERA wouldn't do anything until they got information from GI and other sources. So I think effectively CERA acted as the kind of information broadcaster and interpreter for that particular kind of thing.
One more.
I just want to get, with all this crowdsourcing and centered all over the shop, is this the most observed earthquake and obviously complete series for a year of aftershocks in the world, and if so, is all that kind of crowdsourced data, density of data, is that actually shedding any new light on the whole kind of science of earthquakes?
Dr. Mark Quigley, who I mentioned a couple of times, he's put online there, it's got 80-minute video, and it goes into kind of stuff they recorded, the kind of analysis they've done since, and what that's kind of showing them about earthquakes and kind of new models they can build from it. And his opinion is this probably is the most documented earthquake ever, especially since they put all the sensors out in September, after September 1, and then recorded the following month, February 1. So they have a very dense set of points. And he said this might have been 10 years for the kind of process. Yeah. So, I mean, they're churning out new stuff all the time. His blog, he kind of goes into some latest hypotheses, but I think like he's basically wanting queues of PhD students to turn up and do all the work for him.
Yeah. Well, I'm just wondering in terms of what's predictive, not that people are interested in more.
Yeah.
Is a predictability of the earthquake. Where does it actually happen? But I guess it's going to take you 5 years to chunt to process.
I think it's interesting to point out that no one can predict everything. Yeah. All you can do is describe probabilities of things happening. So he talked quite often about the fact that like if you had a 7.1, then you've got to expect there to be a 6 at some stage. But kind of the likelihood of that drops off. So like every day you go to their website, there'd be a new percentage probability of a 6. But that was my kind of year, so everyone was like, oh, come. And of course, the other thing that people are worried about now is the Alpine fault still hasn't gone. So we're like, are we going to go through this again with an Alpine fault incident? And although it's that much further away, the kind of scale of the quake is so large that it will actually be about the same, I think, in Christchurch. So back to your point, they need to construct buildings which can take back in that kind of sequence of events. And also, the other thing with the earthquake from the Alps is, because it's along the fault line, it will actually be a much slower shape. And Mark gave a really good explanation of this, which I didn't build, but he had a wooden block with different length poles on it, and he shook it really quickly, like the small poles vibrate, but the big ones kind of does this. And then he shakes the same thing really slowly, and the big one's doing this, and the small ones are like fairly stationary. And he was saying, depending on the frequency of the shape, obviously different buildings at different heights are affected differently. And so you can see that in his video, but and so the Alpine fault could potentially be quite different. So even if you could predict it, you have to know where it is, you have to know like which bits of it are fracturing, and then the frequency to actually work out what the impact is on the human. So there's so many other variables in it, apart from just having the focus, and I think that's the risk.
Well, what about the risk or the danger of this earthquake, this new set of faults that I've discovered that you just get stress transmitted through the fault network, and no idea of that. Less likely to happen because I've also been
It's a good point. I didn't actually point this out, but it started on kind of the planes and it worked its way eastwards. So it was almost like pushing a piece of paper up and paper kind of lets itself go to the east. So they've kind of been heading out to the sea. So they kind of think that again, it's never a full statement. In fact, it's always like a probability that the earthquakes are heading eastwards away from New Zealand. So now it's too smart becomes a
I think there was one. So take one final question from the back there.
You said that when the first wave hit and was the Christchurch game, everyone was surprised because everyone expected to call the Alpine fault. So it's presumably it's quite usual to get these third earthquakes happening less than close to the Christchurch. But with two active faults, even if the magnitude ends up being the same in Christchurch, for two active faults, the likelihood of an earthquake must increase. Does that mean the insurance premiums for buildings in Christchurch
So what they've discovered is they've done some surveys of the planes and found faults everywhere. And insurance is a real issue. I kind of skipped over the slide, but what's happened is if you buy a new house now, buy a house, and you try and get house insurance, you can't get it. So basically, house insurance has been stopped, but you can transfer your insurance. So like if you own a house, you can change it, from perhaps owner-occupied to rental or something like that. You can't get new insurance. New Zealand as a whole is in a real a bigger problem, that they can't get reinsurance. So there's now state assets like power lines, sewage infrastructure, all kind of thing, that's just not insured, and they can't get anyone to reinsure it. The $5 billion that they had in the EPC fund disappeared, and there's actually, I think it's $11 billion now, it's kind of based on the cost of the fix, so they obviously need another $6 billion. So there's, insurance is a major issue, and they're trying to get people to insure, but it's just too much of a liability, so you're right there. In terms of how GIS can help, I think it's really more geologists who are making maps and then using GIS to present, and obviously they have their own special, specific kind of modelling packages. Perhaps GIS based in this kind of area is more to do with relating information to the public, or allowing people like Riven, like quake.pro.co.uk website, allowing people to interact with this data and actually kind of explore it, kind of get sucked in. Like everyone can start using that site just because of the way it expresses data so much more interactively than static maps and that kind of thing. So I suspect that perhaps web mapping in a way to deliver this information is perhaps the biggest role that GIS can take in terms of that kind of thing.
Well, I think it remains for me to say thank you very much again to Phil for an interesting talk and a range of videos. I'm going to sit and watch them again, I hope, when we get the PowerPoint up. So there should be some refreshments, and just before we thank Phil, I'll say that the final talk for Christmas, we're all going to the beach, despite it being December, Friday the 2nd of December, for some GIS exploration in the coastal zone. And I'm hoping that we can touch on road sensing, GIS, and even perhaps archaeology. So there should be something for everyone there for the Christmas present. So, again, without further ado, I'd say thanks once again to Phil.